Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, and before I move on, let me say what a tremendous victory for Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel, and most of all, for the state of Michigan. A federal appeals court this week ruled that Nessel's case to shut down the old and rickety Line 5 oil pipeline at the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac must be returned to state court. And that's where it should have been this whole time, since it was and has always been a state's rights issue. Attorney General Nessel filed a case to shut down Line 5 in 2019. But Canadian oil company Enbridge, which transports crude oil from Wisconsin into the UP under the Straits of Mackinac and through the Lower Peninsula and reaching its final destination to Sarnia, Ontario, utilized some good old-fashioned delay tactics by arguing the case had to be moved to federal court. So here we are, 5 years later, and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals says this case is indeed a state issue and should then be resolved in state court. I mean, that's a victory for Nessel. But as I said, it's a victory for Michigan, which relies on the Great Lakes for economic and environmental reasons. Please recall, Line 5 could have been shut down long ago, but the then Republican majority in Lansing passed a bill in lame duck allowing Enbridge to build a tunnel around the 70-year-old pipeline. And it's a bill that Rick Snyder signed into law. Yes, the same Rick Snyder who was also responsible for the Flint water crisis, and the same Ricky Snyder who's joined forces with rich right-wingers to help the MAGA Republican Party take back control of the state house this fall. Yes, that Rick Snyder. He's never cared about anybody but himself, or at least those in his group. Oil money talked, and Ricky Snyder and the Republicans danced for them at the detriment to the Great Lakes and the Michigan's future. But Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer made it her campaign pledge in 2018 to shut down Line 5, and so has AG Nessel. And while there have been many, many frustrating moments, this is one time where we progressives and independents can actually celebrate that our side won at least a round here in this fight. At a time when Michigan is, thanks to Governor Whitmer and the Democratic majority, moving to expand our clean energy portfolio for the future with wind and solar energy and even some other clean energy sources, relying on this old pipeline is outdated and is honestly bad business. I mean, think about it. This pipeline was around before Mr. Sandman was even released. Yeah, go look that up. You see, most of the dirty crude Canadian oil is used in Canada. And Michigan, and more importantly, the Great Lakes, are just a go-between for Enbridge's pocketbook. As I wrote about last year on leftoflansing.com, a former Dow chemical engineer named Gary Street said that shutting down Line 5 will not lead to catastrophic gas raises, despite Enbridge's scare tactics. And Street told Michigan Advance last year that we know it won't lead to massive gas price hikes because we've got some real-world experience already, and that's when an anchor hit the pipeline a few years ago, causing both lines to shut down for 19 days, and then the West Line was closed for 83 days. And guess what? The price hikes were negligible at best. Here's what Street told Michigan Advance, and I quote, "If Michigan was successful in shutting down Line 5, Enbridge, the refineries, and some of the media predicted a steep price escalation within a matter of days for Michigan and Toronto. Their predictions were grossly exaggerated and proved to be incorrect. None were even close to being correct. Instead, the increase was negligible. If Line 5 were shut down again, the increase would be negligible again. Why? Large corporations never depend on a single source supplier. They have several. If one is unable to fulfill its portion of the feedstock, they turn to others to make up for the shortfall. There are several studies that show a minimal impact on gas prices if Enbridge were to shut down." And also, don't forget the study conducted by a consultant hired by Enbridge revealed that closing the pipeline results in a price hike of half of 1 cent per gallon. Half of 1 cent per gallon. And despite all the subsidies, the billions of dollars in subsidies that we give oil and gas companies, the price of gas still remains above $3.50 per gallon. And that's even with the precious Line 5 oil pipeline. So please let that be a lesson. Don't fall for the scare tactics that are used by Enbridge and Big Oil and Gas. It's a good win in a long battle for saving Michigan's environmental and economic future, and a good win for Attorney General Nessel. Which leads me to ask all of you, do you really think, had Nessel lost to MAGA Republican Tom Leonard in 2018 or MAGA Republican insurrectionist Matt DiPerno in 2022, that there'd even be a case brought by the state of Michigan to shut down Line 5? Do you really think that would have happened without Dana Nessel? Do you think, had Bill Schuette defeated Whitmer in the governor's race in 2018, that always on duty Bill Schuette would have put Michigan's economic survival above the interest of big oil and big gas? Do you really think that? You think MAGA Republican Tudor Dixon would have fought for Michigan's interest? Really? You think Tudes would have been on the people's side or the corporation side? I'm saying this to remind you that as important as this year's presidential election is, and it is, as I'm going to talk about here in just a moment, so is keeping Michigan's entire state legislature blue just as important. You see, Michigan Democrats are working on behalf of the people and are working to help people. Michigan MAGA Republicans are working on behalf of their corporate elite class, which will allow them to run our lives in their weird right-wing Christian nationalist image. And speaking of Matt DiPerno, the guy who got trounced by Nessel in 2022 and then who got arrested and is facing charges for illegally accessing voting machines because he was going to prove that the election was stolen, that the 2020 election was stolen from his dear leader Trump. Yeah, that guy. He just announced he's running for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. Oy, Matt DiPerno said in a statement, and I'm quoting here, "After watching the abuse of our legal system both here in Michigan as well as across the country, it is clear that the Michigan Supreme Court needs members that are committed to following the Constitution and the rule of law." Do these MAGA people hear themselves when they're talking? I don't think they do. I mean, following the Constitution and rule of law? Matt, you didn't do that! But you see, like with Dear Leader and right-wing bloviator Steve Bannon and so many others, getting arrested is apparently a badge of honor, and it's almost like a prerequisite to run for office as a Republican nowadays. Salon columnist and good friend of the podcast Amanda Marcotte wrote this week about Dear Leader Trump's religious MAGA cheerleader named Robert Morse, who's been accused that he molested a girl when she was just 12 years old. 12 years old. Morris is the head of the Gateway Church that's somewhere around the Dallas suburbs. He was also on Dear Leader's Evangelical Executive Advisory Board during the 2016 campaign. So he was close to Trump during the 2016 campaign. Oh, by the way, Morris was in his 20s and married at the time of the alleged molesting. But as Amanda Marcotte notes in her column titled "Another Evangelical Abuse Scandal, It's a Big Reason Why They Worship Trump," she writes, "It appears that church leaders knew about Morris's conduct all along, but kept it to themselves after concluding there were no other moral failures." The victim says she considered suing Morris or the church in 2005, but backed off when Morris's lawyer accused her of being quote-unquote flirtatious. Because you see, I mean, what was Morris supposed to do? To the church elders, it's the 12-year-old's fault, not the older and pious religious leader's fault. Marcotte quotes a sociologist named Samuel Perry who said, and I quote, "Evangelical churches teach that God gave men tremendous sexual appetites because he wanted them to be leaders and initiators and people who take charge. If that will to dominate sometimes leads to molesting a 12-year-old, well, then that's just a risk of those appetites they so admire." And Marcotte continues here, "Blame for that kind of sexual abuse tends to be shifted to the victims, who may find themselves, as the woman in this case says she did, accused of tempting those poor, vulnerable men with their uncontrollable desires." I know I brought this up before. But you've heard how these MAGA right-winger types always espouse personal responsibility and of always being for law and order. Did you really think they were talking about themselves? Or whenever they pontificated about the lack of family values in this country, you knew they never looked in the mirror. And yet they go on and on and on trying to attack the transgender community or drag queens and say they're inappropriate for children and they lack the moral compass that we need in this country. It's always the projection when it comes to MAGA Republican Christian nationalists. It's always the projection. I think it's safe to say that these Christian nationalists, these evangelical leaders, I think it's easy to say that they're more of a danger to children than drag queens. I think the evidence is showing that, but there they are. There are these evangelical leaders, these Christian nationalists huddled close to Dear Leader, who he himself has been found liable in court for sexual assault. But he and all these evangelical leaders, they are the ones celebrated by MAGA. They have no problem that this Robert Morris did anything with a 12-year-old girl while he was in his 20s and married. They don't care about Dear Leader being a sexual assaulter and as someone who banged porn stars while his wife gave birth to their son. They don't care how, right here in Michigan, we have a former MAGA Republican Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield, who was accused of sexually abusing a sister-in-law while she was a teenager. Now, those charges were eventually dropped due to insufficient evidence, but that investigation into those charges led to Chatfield and his wife being arrested for running a huge money laundering scheme. But yet these people are the ones who want to regulate who can and cannot be the people they want to be, the people they were born to be, and they want to regulate who people can and cannot love. The real point of this white Christian nationalist movement is how they want to control all of American society, which they believe includes education, entertainment, family, business, religion, media, and government. That's the so-called Seven Mountains Mandate, which many evangelical white Christian nationalists really believe. They want to control how we think, what we can do, and they want to monitor how we live. So despite the evangelical movement being surrounded by all of these sexual predators and celebrating a sexual assaulter as its leader, these guys are claiming that they're the moral ones while they're the exact opposite. They want to control what we do in our everyday lives while granting corporations everything they want to ensure that the gravy train keeps them living high in the hog. And here's the scary part, though. These weird right-wing MAGA Republicans are close, they're close to getting the power that they so crave. We've talked about this Project 2025 here on the show before, which is this white Christian nationalist playbook to turn America from a democracy into a pure authoritarian regime. They're backing Dear Leader not because they really believe he's one of them, but because they know he'll help them enact many of their goals from this Project 2025. Which, as Steve Corbin, professor emeritus of marketing at Northern Iowa, recently covered in the state's newsroom here. He wrote a column there, and he said this Project 25 includes eliminating the Department of Education, eliminating the Department of Commerce, deploying the U.S. military whenever protests erupt, dismantling the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, removing sexual and gender-protected discrimination, and terminating diversity, equity, inclusion, and affirmative action. They'll also, by the way, go after abortion rights and ensure women will not be able to cross state lines to receive abortion care. They'll also make sure to siphon money from public schools to private religious schools, gut free school lunches, and much more. Everyone, this is serious, and it's time for the National Democratic Party leadership to bring this to the attention of all Americans. It's up to them, and that includes President Biden as well. And while I'm at it, it wouldn't be all that bad if maybe the corporate media kind of covers this as well. Maybe at next week's debate between Dear Leader and President Biden, maybe the moderators can ask Dear Leader if he agrees with Project 2025. But actually, maybe it's up to all of us that we've got to share this message with as many people as possible. MAGA is not fighting for democratic values. They are fighting for fascism. Okay, sorry I went off a bit on a tangent there, but these things must be discussed and they must be talked about and shared with as many people, because we're only a few months away from election night and the polls appear to be way too close for my taste. Let me know what you think, leftoflansing@gmail.com, or leave your comments on Twitter. Coming up after the break, Michigan Democratic State Representative Jason Morgan will join me. Now, this interview, I have to tell you, took place last week, as you'll hear, And we were talking about some of the important transit bills that state Democrats are working on. In fact, Senate Democrats already passed bills that would reform the state's corporate slush fund called SOAR in ways that ensures that instead of just shelling out billions of dollars in corporate welfare, that ain't giving us the returns we were promised. So Democrats are working to make sure that some of that money will now be redirected for community upgrades, for additional housing and affordable housing, and yes, for transit upgrades, much needed transit upgrades. Look, if we're going to make Michigan more attractive for people to stay and move here, we need improved transit infrastructure now. I mean, probably should have been happening 10 to 15 years ago, but we need it now. And that's what Representative Morgan and I will discuss here in just a moment. Then, after our talk, since other news on these transit bills broke over the last few days, I'll give my take on a proposal by Democratic state representatives and friends of this podcast, Dylan Wagella and Emily Devendorf, on this week's Last Call. You're listening to LOL.
Left of Lansing podcast. If you truly want to get Pat fired up, talk about Tigers baseball or how you think the 90s produced the worst music of any decade. You've been warned. Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com and follow him on Twitter at leftoflansing. Here's Pat.
I've been looking forward to speaking with this guest for quite some time. He's Democratic State Representative Jason Morgan from the 23rd House District, comprising of Ann Arbor, South Lyon, Salem, and parts of Northville, Plymouth, and Lyon Townships. Representative Morgan, thanks so much for coming on to talk with us here this week. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Pat. It's great to be with you.
Well, look, I'm going to start off here by asking you what I ask every representative or state senator or those running for Congress or those in Congress. What do you like the most about your district, the 23rd district, and why did you want to run to represent it in the state house?
Well, that's, I think, a fun question, so I appreciate it. I will be honest, I am probably one of the most enthusiastic about my district in the house because it's just such an amazing district to represent. I have amazing people. It is fully in line with my generally pretty progressive and pragmatic values. And so it truly is an amazing place to represent the students and campus in Ann Arbor. I love that. You have kind of somewhat suburb type communities with Plymouth and Northville, and like South Lyon has a cool downtown. So it really is an all around exciting district that is three kind of different points that are wildly different from each other. So it keeps me on my toes. And for me, running for office is just about being a good person here to do good work for the right reasons. And that's why I ran, and I'm excited to keep serving because I think we need more elected officials who are just here to serve people and to be public servants. So that's my goal, get as much good stuff done as I can to help people and prevent as much bad stuff as I can along the way.
So yeah, you're in one of the more populated areas in Michigan, but I was reading through your bio and noticed that you got your bachelor's in political science at Northern Michigan. I take it politics and public service was always in your blood. When did that start exactly for you?
So actually, it was not always in my blood, at least as far as I knew. I grew up in very rural Michigan, a place called Pinconning, Michigan, the cheese capital of our great state here. And you know, honestly, would have never in a million years ever thought I would run for office. I grew up as someone who was LGBTQ and someone who had a disability, and my family did not have a particular amount of wealth or resources or connections. And so, to be honest, people like me didn't run for office where I grew up. I went to school up in the Upper Peninsula, which was even further north, and that's where I got interested in politics and government. I ended up getting an internship for Hillary Clinton and then a job with my congressman. And it just pulled me in from there. And 13 years ago, I moved to Ann Arbor and started working for Congressman John Dingell. Fast forward 13 years, here I am serving in the state house, representing part of Ann Arbor. And it's been a wild and incredible ride, but I'm just so happy with how it has all worked out so far.
When you said you worked for a congressman, well, which one was that?
I was Congressman Bart Stupak, who was my congressman growing up.
I remember him. You stated that you're from the Pinconning area. So I've been asking this question lately to some rural Democrats and progressives throughout the state. I've been asking this question, so I'm going to ask it to you. What do you think that Democrats could be doing better in communicating with rural voters and convincing them that Democrats are working for them and their families and for their futures?
Well, you know, where I grew up back, I almost said back in my day, but which is funny because a lot of people think I'm quite young. But where I grew up there, it was a lot of people were a bit more purple, where there were some Labor Democrats and folks in Bay County that have turned a little bit more Republican today. But what ultimately folks in rural communities want is that they want to make sure their tax dollars are being spent well. They want to know that the government's only taking everything that they absolutely need to provide basic services. And they want good government, and they want to be left alone in many respects, whether that comes to what you do in your bedroom or with your body or what you do in your day-to-day life. And I think those are all things that Democrats really focus on or can focus on. But sometimes in rural places, folks get caught up in more conservative social ideas that I think are not really consistent with their values otherwise. And I think there's just a sense that government isn't really doing enough for them or listening to them enough because of them being in rural places. So I've loved being somebody who grew up in rural Michigan, working in politics statewide and working in a city like Ann Arbor that is kind of the complete opposite in terms of how we operate here, just so I can have that broader understanding. One of the biggest things that we need to know as elected officials and Democrats is that every part of our state has different needs and people are concerned about different priorities. And we have to be able to understand that and make policy that respects that as much as possible. So I think that's something that's really important that really can help us appeal to everyone.
And maybe one way is through the idea of mass transit and upgrading transit. This is something that I've been harping on here for quite some time, especially since I restarted this podcast. So I know that you are part of a transit caucus. I think it is the Public Transit Caucus. And there's a plan that House Democrats are trying to get across the finish line when it comes to transit. And I was wondering if you could talk about that in more detail here for the listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am very excited to share this package of bills that we've put together with Representatives McFaul and Hoskins in partnership with Senator McMorrow and Kavanaugh in the Senate. You know, we've been having this big conversation around economic development for the last couple of years in Michigan. And one of the frustrations I had last year with the way that we're doing economic development through a particular program, the SOAR Business Incentive Program, was that I felt like you have to have a more comprehensive approach. You can't just attract businesses here if their people can't get to work and they have nowhere to live. Housing and transit have to be connected, and we have to invest in our infrastructure. I've been harping on this message for a year now, a year and a half as a legislator. And we've finally said, okay, let's do something about this. Let's come together and put together what that package could look like. And that's what we've done. So right now, we have this historic opportunity to pass a plan that is a comprehensive, long-term economic development plan for the state, inclusive of transit, affordable housing and workforce housing, attracting jobs and businesses, but in a more transparent and accountable way, and investing in community revitalization and placemaking all together in one package that really can appeal to everyone. And so there are three big pieces to this. $200 million a year for a transformational transit mobility fund that would provide a statewide vision for what transit looks like in Michigan. We're talking like rail, light rail, bus rapid transit, the type of big projects that we've never been able to do in our state. $200 million a year for that, $100 million a year for affordable and workforce housing, $250 million a year for economic development that is geared toward higher wage jobs with some more accountability mechanisms than we've had in place in the past to make sure that as we're creating these jobs, the money really is accountable to the state and to the people, to make sure that their tax dollars are being spent wisely, which is super possible. It's something we can absolutely do better on. And then this $50 million a year for a revitalization and placemaking fund. In my mind, this is the total package. It's like a win-win for all of the critical areas of growth that we've been talking about in Michigan. We have to create jobs and attract folks to move here. We need housing for people to live in that they can afford. and we need to build a heck of a lot more housing across the board. And we have to have a mass transit plan for our state if we're going to be attracting people long into the future. That's something that we've always been missing out on. We've never had a plan this big in that arena. And so I'm thrilled to put this together. It's truly kind of a win-win and compromise approach that pulls everything together and hopefully everyone together.
Where is it right now? What stage are we at in the House when it comes to this package?
So as of today, this recording on June 10th, we've had a committee hearing in the House Representatives House Economic Development Committee, and we had almost 100 supporters support this package. We had one card of opposition from the Mackinac Center of Public Policy. And
not surprising. Okay, go on.
I think if I'm doing something that is on the other end of them, I think I'm in good shape with what I'm working on. But what's been really exciting is the cards of support were from labor, environmental folks, the transit community, the business community, you know, just like a wild broad range, local governments, Michigan Municipal League. Like it was just this wild coalition of a whole lot of different people supporting this package, which is truly rare. Ultimately, this has to pass the House, go back to the Senate, and then negotiate between the differences in the Senate and the House and with the executive office to get to a final version that everybody would be comfortable with, or at least as happy as you can be in any compromise deal. And then we'd get it passed, hopefully, at some point here.
Right, because the Senate has already passed its own version of what you're already examining right now, right?
Correct. But what a lot of folks don't know is that where this package has come from in the House is it really has been building upon the work of the executive office and the Senate. So the governor put out her proposal in the existing program that we have through economic development. The Senate took that work over the last few months and they put out their own proposal for this. Senator McMorrow and Senator Kavanaugh have led that kind of changes this program and changes what gets invested in with economic development. And then we're building on that by getting more specific with directly creating a mass transit fund for Michigan, directly putting more into the affordable and workforce housing fund, and then continuing with the work they've done to slice that business incentive part in half to make room for these other investments that are important too.
I recently talked with a CEO of Michigan Future, Lou Glazer here, and he stressed how transit upgrades are desperately needed if Michigan is going to become a more prosperous and attractive state for people to live. Just from what I'm reading, you know, maybe on social media and also maybe just opposition to any kinds of bills when it comes to transit, is that I think that we're just going up against some long-held traditions in our state. Most of all, that, of course, we're known as the auto capital of the world. From what you've been seeing, is that the biggest challenge maybe that it's more like, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for. Maybe it's just how it's been a part of our society. It's like it'd be a huge social change getting people used to the idea that, you know what, not everyone wants to own a car. Not everyone wants a car to get to where they're going and that we need something different.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, this is really a generational thing. The folks who I have found most resistant to investing in public and mass transit have not been young people, to be blunt. I've had a lot of folks who are a few years senior to me who said to me that they know what young people want and they want to drive their darn cars. And my answer back to that is no. As a young person who bought a house last year with my husband in Ann Arbor, and wants to help our state grow and has a lot of friends who, some of which have decided to stay here and others who've moved to big cities because of mass transit and walkable communities and vibrant downtowns. You know, I'm tired of my friends moving away and a whole lot of us are tired of our friends moving to bigger cities for these amenities. We have to create a state that has these types of places and grows these types of places. If we're going to grow our state and our economy long term, and create a better place to live and have a cleaner environment and more accessible communities. We can and we need to do all of these things. And a lot of it really is generational. And the other really important piece here, going back to what we discussed earlier around growing up in rural Michigan, is that a lot of times people think that the same solution works for every part of the state. And it just isn't the case. So as we're working on transit investments here, we're trying to make sure that we're not only investing in the cities, but we're investing statewide so that everybody receives some piece of what they need as much as you can in one bill to be able to invest in improving mobility in those places. So from Traverse City to Marquette, all the way down to Detroit and Grand Rapids, we've put in a little bit of flexibility for the rural parts of our state to make sure that they're able to invest those mobility dollars in the way that they feel will be the most effective. Because unfortunately, you need some density for transit to work as well as you want. Traditional transit like rail or like dedicated buses. But there are other services that you can do, like call for a ride type services to get seniors to doctor's appointments or people with disabilities to places they need to go or veterans to veteran services, things like that. And so we're making sure that this is a package that doesn't just say like, here's a one size fits all approach for the entire state, but really does understand that every part of our state has different needs and needs to be able to use the dollars flexibly.
If we are going to grow our state, and because I mean, that was what part of the governor's committee's report, I'm drawing a blank now, the name of the committee, but when they were looking into how to grow our population, I mean, that's exactly what you guys are tackling now.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is we're doing exactly what we've heard people need to have. So the Governor's Population Council, I'm sure it's called something different, the Growing Michigan Together Council, but
that's it.
That council said exactly what we're doing. They said, we need housing, we need affordable housing, and we need mass transit and vibrant communities that people want to like live in with like great downtowns. That's all of what we're doing. And so it's important for folks to know that we didn't just like wake up and come up with this grand idea. No, we've just been listening to the conversation and been part of it over the last couple of years. And what we've put together in partnership with some folks is this package that brings it all together so that everybody wins as much as you can. And we move all these things forward in a comprehensive and truly holistic way.
You know, I've almost taken up all your time. So I just have one more question, if you don't mind. I heard you say it here, and I've seen you say it in some other interviews to Representative Morgan, where you said, I think you described yourself as a pragmatic progressive. I was wondering if you could maybe expound on that. It's just if you wouldn't mind, maybe just give more of a definition of what you think makes up a pragmatic progressive.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. That's something I've always been very particular about because I've grown up as somebody who's been an activist and a tireless pusher for doing good public policy and progressive public policy, housing, public transit, LGBTQ rights, reproductive rights, environmental work. I just saw a photo pop up on my social media the other day of me meeting with Congressman Stupak as a student advocating for environmental legislation as part of a progressive environmental coalition, I think 15 years ago. I've been doing this work for a really long time, but I've also learned over my years that we have to find ways to build coalitions to get things done. And so I describe myself as a pragmatic progressive because I'm 100% progressive in my values and want to make sure that we're getting things done at the end of the day. And what that means to me is like, there's some things that I really want to see in policy that don't work quite yet, or we can't get the support for today, but we're going to keep working toward it. The sort of mantra I take is, let's achieve what's possible today while working to make more things possible tomorrow. And that's what I live by. Let's keep pushing, getting as much done as we possibly can. But at the end of the day, trying to make sure that we're progressing forward as much as we possibly can and doing that in the right way.
I get that too, because one of my favorite quotes in politics of all time is from JFK. And I think he said, hope I'm getting this right, but he said, I'm an idealist without illusion. I'm one who also is willing to sometimes accept half if you can't get everything, because at least then, even if you just get half, you've got a starting point where you can build from. You know, I would say like with the clean energy bills that Democrats passed last year, was it everything that I wanted? No. Were there a couple of things that maybe I was like, oh, I don't know why they went that way. But at the same time, I was like, you know what? 2 years ago, I didn't think anything like that was possible. And I just looked at it as a starting point. And if you can get to that starting point, then you can improve on things later on.
Yes, that's exactly how I look at it. And I've been called idealistic many times in my life. And I think I'm idealistic and realistic. Yeah. I want to set big goals and be sensible and pragmatic about how we achieve them.
Democratic State Representative Jason Morgan from House District 23. Thanks so much for being on this week. And thanks for talking about these very important bills, because I believe that House Democrats are illustrating to the voters out there that not only are they looking at the evidence that is showing simply shelling out hundreds hundreds of millions of dollars in corporate subsidies isn't exactly the best way to grow the state, but you're also showing the voters out there that you care about the future of the state when it comes to more affordable housing, when it comes to upgrading our infrastructure, and when it comes to the future of transit. It is so important for Democrats to show that they are the party that's always looking towards the future and not just trying to keep pushing us back into the past. So Representative Morgan, thanks so much for being on. Good luck for the rest of the year. And hey, I'd love to have you back again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Pat.
Okay, that was my interview with Representative Morgan from last week. Since we recorded that interview, there have been some developments on these bills, which I will discuss coming up here after the break during The Last Call. You're listening to LOL.
It's Michigan's premier progressive podcast, Left of Lansing with Pat Johnston. If Pat's brand of progressive pontifications is getting you all riled up and you'd like to give him a piece of your mind, or if you'd like to tell him he's doing an outstanding job and to keep up the great work, just email him. That's leftoflansing@gmail.com. Do you have stories you think Pat must know about or guest ideas for future episodes? That's leftoflansing@gmail.com. Want to share your thoughts on how to grow Michigan's population or which flavor of Faygo Pop is the best? It's Rock and Rye, by the way. Just email Pat, leftoflansing@gmail.com. Now, here's Pat.
Good talk there with Democratic State Representative Jason Morgan, and he reminded me off the air how he's the vice chair of the state Democratic Party. The representative said that he would love to return in the fall and talk about the election, and Representative Morgan, I will hold you to that. So, hey, I'd love to have you back on again soon. And as you could hear, I wanted to ask him that philosophical question on what it meant being a quote-unquote pragmatic progressive. I heard Representative Morgan use that term a few times, and I wanted him to explain it here, and I thought he gave a good, clear answer. He believes that as long as some progressive policies are pushed forward and implemented, even if that means needing to scale back on some other progressive goals for now, hey, that's the best path forward. And I mostly agree with that belief, which is why you heard me say that while there were aspects of the Clean Energy and Jobs Act that I disagreed with, notably considering natural gas a clean energy source and not holding DTE and consumers energy to higher standards, I still supported the package because if you told me 3 years ago Michigan would pass such a wide-ranging energy, environmental, and jobs package, I would have thought that you were nuts. So yes, you sometimes have to compromise, even if that means with some in your own party. But that doesn't mean we always have to compromise on our progressive values. Sometimes progressives can yield some negotiating power themselves and fight for some of the important initiatives and goals that we believe in. Yeah, it's not against the rules to do that, everyone. And it's my belief that the further we nudge policy towards a progressive direction, the more we not only pass bills that will demonstrably help so many people, but also the more we move the Overton window, which has shifted to the far right in both Michigan and the state. Which leads me now to the Left of Lansing Last Call. So there have been some recent developments when it comes to scaling back on some of the corporate slush fund spending that we've been pouring into the SOAR fund and putting some of that money towards reinvestments in our people and their communities in transit and housing. Since my talk with Representative Morgan last week, the bills that he and fellow Democrats Jason Hoskins of Southfield and Mike McCall of Hazel Park have been pushing past the House committee last week by an 8-3 vote, meaning the legislation moves on to the House floor. Congratulations, guys. Now, this package would switch the SOAR fund into the Make It Michigan fund, and the structure would be somewhat different than the SOAR fund. So, for example, each year, at least $200 million would get directed into public transit. All right. And up to $100 million would go into housing and community development, and at least $50 million would be spent on community revitalization. The money would be spent equitably across the state, by the way. The Michigan Environmental Council says if the State House does indeed pass these bills, it could most likely become the biggest investment in public transit in the state's history. I mean, this is huge. I mean, had you told me 3 years ago we'd get significant upgrades in public transit spending, I think you were crazy, and I'd ask you if you also thought the Lions would be one of the better teams in the NFL by 2024. I wouldn't have believed you. And on top of that, as the real estate market is pricing so many people out of buying homes. More investments in housing, clean energy, and energy-efficient homes is what we need to help bring down some of those prices. I mean, come on, people. We know that owning a home is a family's best way to invest in a solid financial future, of course, but this isn't sustainable. Homeowners will still earn money in equity, but it won't be as much if we add more affordable housing, which in the end will lift all boats. We all know that, which is why, even though I support this whole bill package, I will not criticize, but I will instead tip my cap to progressive Democratic representatives Dylan Wagella and Emily Devendorf, who are doing something that Democrats rarely try to do: use their negotiating muscle for a slightly better deal. Now, I have been on the record of never believing in corporate welfare, and you can go back to episodes from 2019 where I voiced such opposition. In fact, I talked about it with State Senator Mallory McMorrow, who is a big believer in what Democrats are doing right now in reinvesting more in public transit and housing. So I like to believe that I've been mostly consistent on this issue. I'm not a fan of how this much-needed investment in transit and housing is tied to another decade of filling a corporate slush fund worth over $2 billion, which is why I support a proposal by Wagella and Devendorf that would raise the corporate income tax by 1%, move $150 million annually from the corporate slush fund into housing, and then tie bar the package to legislation reducing school district Michigan public school employee retirement system contributions. That last one's a big one, too. Also, Wagella and Devendorf are fighting to further reduce spending into the corporate slush fund and instead direct more spending into housing and community development. Now, this is what I call negotiating with some strength. And I can't believe their counterproposal is something that we progressives are upset about. We know the SOAR program did not give us the promised return on investment. And I'll repost my interview with Bridge Magazine's Paula Gardner from a few months ago because she did an extensive study on the shortcomings of the SOAR fund's promises. So I'll be watching to see what happens with these negotiations. But if Emily Devendorf and Dylan Wagella can at least win 50% of their proposal, I think I would consider that a major victory for progressives. It's negotiating with power and conviction. It's negotiating for the common good, which has always been my theme for this podcast. The overall bill package is something I support, but I'd support it even more if those progressive proposals are added in. And I think many Democratic, Republican, and independent voters agree too.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
That's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Email your thoughts on what we covered here on this week's show or past shows or what I talk about on the Monday Musings or the Friday Short. That's leftoflansing@gmail.com. With the first presidential debate, by the way, taking place next week, I like to present a Left of Lansing Twitter poll question. Do you believe Dear Leader Trump shows up for the debate? Yes, no, not sure. I think he'd love to back out, but he knows he can't in the fear of looking so weak. But his people are already out there complaining about the debate rules and already complaining about Biden's performance before the event even takes place. So I think he'd love to back out, but he knows he can't do it. Stay cool out there. I'm sorry. I just don't understand how some of you enjoy this kind of weather. I mean, you can't move or think when it's this stifling hot. I just don't get it. Don't forget to subscribe to Left of Lansing and also follow us on YouTube. Until next week, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.